Thank you.
Your Honors, I'm Philip Turner, and it's my pleasure to represent Trevor Jones. In 1996, at the age of 18, Trevor recklessly killed in the course of a robbery. He was convicted of conspiracy to rob and felony murder after the appellate courts reviewed his initial sentences, and he was sentenced to life without parole because that was the court's only choice. 18 years later, he's now asking you to remand this case for resentencing because the circumstances of his case have never been effectively reviewed as required by Miller. The circumstances of his youth have never been considered, and the Eighth Amendment now demands that he have that opportunity. In fact, the Attorney General acknowledges that the sentence here violates the Eighth Amendment, and so we're really debating the remedy, not the fact of the unconstitutional imposition of a sentence. The government relies primarily on arguments of severance and revival, and relies upon a case that this court released last year, People versus Banks, which adopted the severance argument.
Counsel, given that you reference the Banks case and also your supplemental authority notified us that Banks, Tate, and Jensen are before the Colorado Supreme Court with the same issue that we have here, I'm wondering whether in light of those cases, whether you and your opposing counsel had conferred on asking the Supreme Court to take this case directly?
I filed a cert petition prior, about 6 or 8 months back, and it was denied. But they did take another case pre-argument, the Jensen case. That was one of the three. I don't know why, of course, they did what they did, but I did make that effort.
Thank you.
We did not confer. I did it on my own. As we know, the Eighth Amendment requires consideration of the frailties of youth, and this is a case, the Miller case, that the trial court did not have the benefit of when it ruled on the post-conviction motion. So it was not in a position to set aside the sentence. The court has to consider the age of the individual who is 17 in this case, his relative immaturity. There are many factors, we'll call them the Miller factors, but another one is the failure to appreciate the risks. That's particularly important in this case because my client was found by the jury to have acted recklessly. The court, of course, has to consider the circumstances of the offense, the family and home environment, the possibility of rehabilitation. None of that took place in this case.
Counsel, if we did remand, under what framework would the trial court sentence your client, since there's agreement here that at least a portion of the statute is unconstitutional? Does the rest of the statute remain? Do we revert to a different framework?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your opponent suggests. So what is the trial court to do, or what are we to do?
Courts across the country grapple with that and reach various conclusions. And when I watched the Supreme Court argument a couple weeks ago, the same question came up. And I would respectfully submit that if the question is, how do we give guidance to the trial court, which I think is a fair paraphrasing, the answer is actually the trial court's in a better position than you are to solve the puzzle. I say that because the trial court, after conducting a Miller-compliant hearing, will then have all the facts that you do not have and are not in the record yet. No one, of course, could submit with any vitality mitigating and aggravating information to the trial court because the trial court's hands were tied, as she acknowledged when she imposed the sentence. The only guidance you could give a trial court today is the Miller factors. The trial court is well aware of those, or would be. So the trial court will then have not only those factors, which the Supreme Court has given us, but will also have a full factual record on which to rule. And so if your frustration is, what do we do now? And that was the sense of what I got from the Supreme Court. I suggest to you that the appropriate solution is a remand for a full sentencing. And then if there's an appeal, a panel such as yourselves can apply whatever law needs to be applied to whatever issue comes up. The people's position is, of course, that through some slashing and cutting of the statutes, you can tell the trial court the sentence has to be 40 years to life.
Mr. Turner, let me ask you a little bit about the severability. Are you aware of any other case where a section of a statute's been severed in an as-applied challenge?
Not in this court, not in this state, no, I'm not.
Okay, thanks.
And if it's permissible, I would just point you to the Tate opinion, which I realize is unpublished, but does address that issue. That's just one of the defects in the severability argument. Another is, it's not really severability, it's legislative lawmaking. If you listen to the Supreme Court argument, you heard various justices debating what to do with the lawyers, and it sounded like a legislative debate. As we know, that's not our role. If the courts are frustrated that in 2 years the General Assembly has not grabbed this one and done something, I suggest that the thing to remember is that we have our role and they have theirs, and we cannot change what we do to counterbalance what they have or haven't done. Any severance here is really something like going down the street with an asphalt truck and filling in the various potholes. It goes well beyond just striking something. Your Honor, the reason you mentioned is one. Another is it leaves out any way to deal with adult sentences. Those would be subject to some question, because I think the law is adults have to serve life without parole if they're convicted for first-degree murder, and yet the surgery proposed by the people would not account for that. It is not at all clear, and this is really the core of severance, what the legislative intent was. Let me walk you through that. At one point, the maximum penalty for homicide, maximum constitutional penalty, was death. Years ago, Colorado took that off the table for juveniles convicted of first-degree murder. After that, the maximum penalty was life without parole. Colorado took that off the table in 2006. Setting aside for a moment which legislative body's intent we're talking about, whether it's the legislature that was sitting in the early 90s and created the laws we're dealing with, or the 2006 General Assembly that took life without parole off the table for juveniles, it's important to remember that the legislative focus keeps changing. And contrary to what was written in the Banks opinion, I respectfully submit that our legislature has consistently pulled back from the maximum available constitutional penalty. Nor do we even know what that is until we've conducted a Bank or a Miller compliant hearing, at which all the evidence in mitigation and aggravation can be presented, and a judge can apply the factors from Miller and then decide on a constitutionally appropriate sentence.
Counsel, but pursuant to Miller versus Alabama, isn't it just the no possibility of parole component of a juvenile sentence that that's problematic here? I mean, a juvenile could potentially be sentenced to life, but with the opportunity to be paroled at some point.
We disagree, and I say that for a couple of reasons. Probably the best exposition of it is Null versus State, the Iowa Supreme Court opinion, where they spent several pages, 67 to 76 by my notes, talking about how that is a narrow and overly restrained view of the Miller decision. They focused on the fact that Miller wasn't talking just about offenses, but also about the individual defendant, and that in their view, Miller spoke not just to life without parole sentences, but any long sentence. There are cases in other jurisdictions that I've cited in the briefs as well. I think the ones from Florida are instructive. And I think really the question of whether that's appropriate is, of course, going to be answered by our Supreme Court, hopefully sooner rather than later, but I don't think that takes it off your shoulders, unfortunately. The government has also proposed the solution of revival, which is, let's call it a cousin of severance. The two cases that we have, the White case and People versus District Court, are dramatically different. White sanctioned a revival argument, but it was in the context of a bad check statute, and bad checks have been outlawed for as long as anybody can remember. People versus district court, on the other hand, refused to apply a revival argument where they were dealing with whether or not a particular sentence was appropriate. And I submit to you that while it is somewhat easier to decide whether or not something has been criminalized and is wrong, it is much more difficult and appropriate, therefore, for the legislature to debate what the sentence should be or the sentencing range should be for crimes. That's peculiarly a legislative function. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Turner.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. In 1997, the defendant, who was 17 at the time of the murder, was sentenced to a mandatory sentence of life without parole. In 2011, he filed a successive motion for post-conviction relief, alleging that his sentence violated the Eighth Amendment as set forth in Graham v. Florida, the 2010 United States Supreme Court precedent. On June 21st, 2011, the trial court summarily denied that by written order. It was then on June 25th, 2012, that the United States Supreme Court decided Miller v. Alabama, in which it concluded that a mandatory sentence of life without parole for a juvenile validated the Eighth Amendment prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. It was then a few months later, on September 27, 2012, that a panel of this court issued a published decision in People v. Banks. And as counsel discussed, just a few weeks ago, on June 3, 2014, the Colorado Supreme Court heard arguments in Banks, as well as in People v. Tate and Jensen v. People. So the question remains, what is a constitutional and what is a statutorily authorized sentence for the defendant? And I think it's important to note that in looking at this case, Miller only said that you can't have a mandatory sentence of life without parole. It did not say that you could not have a mandatory life sentence. In fact, it said that life sentences could be appropriately imposed. So in looking at Miller, I would argue that it only applies, strictly speaking, with its talk of individualized sentencing to a sentence of life without parole, which Miller tells us may only be discretionary.
Counsel, Mr. Turner suggests that the trial court is better positioned to conduct a sentencing in this case. Why shouldn't we remand and allow the record to be further developed and, you know, for all the aggravating and mitigating factors to be presented and to be made part of the record? Why shouldn't that be the appropriate remedy?
Your Honor, the problem stems from having a legal sentence under Colorado statutes, because a sentence which is not authorized by statute is in fact illegal. So we have one sentence for juveniles who were convicted from 1990 to 2006. It is a mandatory sentence of life without parole. That is one sentence. So after Miller, that mandatory sentence of life without parole becomes unconstitutional to the extent that it is in fact a mandatory sentence. So when we look at what is a trial court to do, the trial court needs guidance from the appellate courts with regard to what constitutes a lawful sentence after Miller. So, as I said, Miller does not require an individualized sentencing hearing except to impose a sentence of life without parole. Now, the Miller court tells us that such a sentence is likened to a sentence of death for an adult. It is one to be sparingly applied. So the question is, what is a lawful sentence under Colorado statutes after Miller? And the people's position is that it has to be a sentence to life imprisonment. For all of recent history, the Colorado legislature has had a sentence to life imprisonment for juveniles who have been convicted of first-degree murder. Since 1977, our legislature has toyed with parole eligibility. Prior to 1977, it was the possibility of parole after 10 years for both juveniles and adults. From 1977 to 1985, it was then the possibility of parole after 20 years. From 1985 to 1990, it was the possibility of parole after 40 years. Then in 1990, it was changed for both juveniles and adults to life without parole. It was changed again for juveniles in 2006 to be life with the possibility of parole after 40 years. But throughout, as I said, all of this recorded time frame, the sentence has been life imprisonment, and such a sentence is lawful under Miller.
But Ms. Robaugh, excuse me, doesn't that narrow reading of Miller, does it really comport with the sea change that's going on with Roper and Graham and Miller, where they're treating juveniles differently? I understand your statutory argument, but certainly the Supreme Court is starting to view the juvenile offender in a different light over time. And I think Miller does reference the Graham reasoning and the Roper reasoning. So how does that fit in with your argument?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it fits in two ways. The first is, as I said, the Miller Court, following the Graham Court, said that a sentence to life without the possibility of parole is akin to a death penalty sentence for an adult, a really extreme punishment. So I think that you have to look at both Graham and Miller with regard to what they say about life without the possibility of parole. That is very narrow category of sentences, again, to be applied under most extreme circumstances. But neither of those cases stand for the proposition that juveniles cannot receive a sentence to life imprisonment with the possibility of parole.
Can you address the concerns that Judge Webb, who authored Tate, raises specifically with, you know, the court effectively creating a juvenile exception in the sentencing portion of the statute?
Your Honor, it is necessary under either severability or the doctrine of statutory revival to apply the statutes as written to adults as they are written, but to sever those sections that are unconstitutional to juveniles. As I read the opinion in the unpublished case, Judge Webb was concerned that, in fact, this had never been done before, and that there were no courts that had been cited that had done this before. In my supplemental authority, I've cited for severability courts in Massachusetts and in Iowa who have done exactly that. They have read out the lack of eligibility for parole as to juveniles, but not to adults. So I think that satisfies that concern about whether it can be done. Similarly, the Florida cases are very interesting with regard to statutory revival, and they have revived previous statutes to make a constitutional remedy for juveniles, and they've done this for juveniles, but not for adults. So I think to the extent that Judge Webb's concern was that this hadn't been done before by any court, it has been done by courts in other states who are grappling with this same issue. And it is an issue that courts have to grapple with, because it's a sea change from the Supreme Court saying that juveniles cannot be sentenced to life without parole for first-degree murder. And they said that such a sentence can be imposed after an individualized sentencing hearing. So we know that much. But at the same time, as I said, we have to have a statutorily authorized sentence under Colorado statutes. And I think that's where the Tate Court went wrong, because it provided no guidance to the trial court as to what would be an appropriate sentence that the trial court could, in fact, impose. As our statutes are written, there is one sentence. It is a mandatory sentence of life without parole. But as I said, the Colorado legislature has consistently, although they have changed over the years parole eligibility, has consistently imposed a life sentence for first-degree murder. We know that is the legislature's intent throughout history since, as I said, at least 1977. So in looking at what is the trial court to do in wake of Miller, the answer is the trial court needs direction in how to impose a lawful sentence. when we look at what our statutes show, our statutes have a scheme which has a sentence of life for both juveniles and adults. Our problem is the statutes as they were composed prior to 2006 and applicable to juveniles say life without parole. So the solution which comports with our statutes is to strike those unconstitutional provisions as to juveniles, leave them as to adults, as the courts in Massachusetts and Iowa have done in using severability, but to give them life with the possibility of parole after 40 years. And the people believe this is a fair and just solution because that's what the juveniles who were convicted from 1985 to 1990 and those convicted for crimes committed after 2006 received. It is a fair and just solution for these juveniles. Now, it's true that our trial courts, like our appellate courts, have been caught a little flat-footed in this circumstance. Certainly the trial court here did not have the benefit of Miller. It is my understanding that as this issue is being litigated in post-Miller, post-conviction motions, some district attorneys' offices have argued that, in fact, Miller should not be applied retroactively to cases that were final at the time that Miller was decided. Now, my office has chosen since the time of Banks in 2011 to take a global position and to not argue that the decision should not be imposed retroactively. But it is my understanding that as this is being litigated in trial courts around the state of Colorado, that trial courts are looking at the question of retroactivity, and I also understand that there's at least one appeal in front of this court on that matter. But that hasn't been decided by any court yet, and it's not among the questions being decided by the Supreme Court currently. I don't really have any further comments for this court. I certainly wanted, as I said, to stress that the legislature's intent has always been to impose a life sentence for a Class 1 felony, and a life sentence is what the people believe the defendant should receive here.
And that proposition, you're just basing it on the language of the statutes themselves as they change over time as opposed to some sort of legislative history that...
Well, yes, okay. It's the fact that they remained constant over time in imposing a life sentence, even though, as I said, the question of parole eligibility has changed over time from 10 to 20 to 40 to none and back to 40. But the life sentence has been a constant, and I believe it would be unprincipled as well as an illegal sentence to impose anything other than a sentence to life on a juvenile offender for first-degree murder. And I would also, as I said, commend to this court's attention those out-of-state courts that have applied the doctrines of severability and also of statutory revival. If this court has no further questions, I'd ask you to essentially affirm the defendant's sentence to life imprisonment and also to affirm the trial court's order.
Ms. Robert, I have a question. Almost when you got to sit down, I know.
I'm happy to use my last 2 minutes effectively.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. So it's the state's position that Miller's limited to the life without parole and the individualized sentencing hearings are only for that class of juvenile offender.
Yes.
So you want us to replace one mandatory sentence for another, but not give any individualized sentencing?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I thank this court for its time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Orbaugh. Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the core of the people's analysis is legislative intent, I think they have tried to explain that life has always been the sentence for first degree murder, and that's not quite true because we had a death penalty and still do. But in any event, there's a dramatic difference between life with parole eligibility at 10 years, or then 20, or then 40, and then the 2006 enactment, which carved out juveniles separate from adults.
But there is no statutory scheme that gives the trial court authority to craft a custom sentence.
I share your frustration, Your Honor, and that is the General Assembly's job to come up with a appropriate scheme.
And in the absence of that, we do have a severability statute.
I'm well aware, Your Honor. I think, though, that severability depends on legislative intent. And where it would be clear what that intent was, with all respect, I think you have the option, or might have had that option. I don't think the legislative intent has been clear here. I'm reminded by the comment in the Miller decision where the author pointed out that as the legislatures around the country passed laws dealing with sentences for homicide, they often didn't, well, they almost never differentiated between adults and children. Here we have one statute in the juvenile code, another in the adult code. The adult code for up till 2006 governed all the sentencing. And to assume that the General Assembly, when it changed the rules, as it did numerous times, was thinking of juveniles is a bit of a stretch. And that's not me speaking. I think that's the author of the Miller opinion pointing that out. So we cannot legislate, and I would urge this court to send this matter back for a full hearing under Miller, at which time a record will get developed, and if there's a necessary appellate proceeding, we can deal with it then. So I thank you very much for your time, unless there are other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you again, Mr. Orbaugh.